Hi, everyone. It's Jill Trebilcock here. Thanks, Vin's had to bring me in because somebody had been playing with my levels. But anyway, I am here with the wonderful, the marvelous, fabulous Max Egan. Egan, how do you say it, Max?
Max Egan. Nice to be here, Max. Julian.
Yeah, good to have you. It's good to have a fellow Australian. I was going to bring us in with that Paloma Faith song about being upside down. But anyway, just because we're both Aussies, and I've been looking for some Aussie sovereigns because I got interested in sovereignty, through Vin and People's Internet Radio. And, I don't know enough about it. And by sovereign, I don't mean capital S sovereign in a lot of ways, but what I really mean is people who recognize their own sovereignty. And that's one thing I did find interesting about you. Where I want to lead towards is you and I were having a conversation earlier on, and we were speaking about the importance of having referendums and people actually having a say in their democracy, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it is important if we're going to participate in what is supposed to be a democracy, we should participate. And the concept of people's initiated referendums would be one way to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Because at the moment it is a dictatorship, and somebody was suggesting a benevolent dictatorship, but it's so hard once you have a dictatorship to have there's no such thing as a permanent benevolent dictatorship.
Well, yeah, I think what we really need is self-governance, but we've got a long way to go to get back to there. You know, we need people of integrity before we can be in a state of self-governance, but what we got to realize is that there's a lot wrong with this system, you know, but it is salvageable if we were to participate in the system. And there's various ways we can do that, and we should. We've got to find some way out of this mess. And, you know, I've been trying different approaches with people for a long time now, trying to get people's attention to the fact that we've got a problem. But even when you do get people's attention, it's finding a way out of the situation, you know. I mean, I keep saying common unity is a good thing. You know, we need to put this respect back in our community so we've got a strong communal response to anything our government's tried to do. But what will that strong communal response be? Well, how about publicly instituted referendums? You know, this could work. I mean, you know, we've got to find some way out of this mess. We've got to find some language with which to communicate this information to people that they can understand, you know. You've got to be able to speak to people in a language they can understand. And that's really all they understand is politics and money and tax and all this sort of stuff. So trying to use the system, I mean, it is a double-edged sword. There is parts of it that could work against itself if we chose to participate. And that's what I'm kind of suggesting. I mean, I've tried so many things, Jillian, to wake the world up. I've tried workshops. I've tried films. I've tried anything I can think of to get attention, to try to get information to people, because attention really is the most valuable resource on the planet, and it's getting people's attention.
Well, absolutely.
So
this is really interesting what you're saying, Max, because we've got this. I would just really love if I could bring in the leader of the Direct Democracy Party and also other things called Ben Gilroy. What did you say to this show? And Ben is actually in the chat box, and I've just invited him in, Max, because, and here he is. Here comes Ben Gilroy, who, Vin, what other sort of labels could we attach to Ben Gilroy?
Ben will fit in himself. He'll be on the call now.
How are you, folks? How are you?
We're great, Ben. Thank you. It's such an honor to have you here and privilege. And as you know, this is you and Max know each other?
I met Max in Dublin a few years ago. I'm not sure if he remembers, but I met him in a Whitehall. There was a bit of a party late one night outside a house in Whitehall.
Okay. Yeah. I remember being outside a house in Whitehall.
That was I met you as well, Max.
Yeah, okay.
You were a bit under the weather, Max.
Well, yeah, I've been kind of rushed off to Ireland on a moment's notice, and suddenly we were partying at the back of, I think it was back of Ruth Kelly's place, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah, that's right, there you got it. Okay. And you liked our ish kabaha a little too much, I think, Max.
yeah, it was a good night. I ended up going to Gaza a couple of days later. Okay.
That's right, yeah. You were off to Gaza, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is actually... But you were just talking about earlier on there about people initiating referendum. As you know, Max, we set up a direct democracy party here. And the system, of course, at every opportunity tries to destroy that principle. It was in Ireland's first constitution, direct democracy, where you gather enough signatures and call a referendum. Of course, the powers that be took it out without any referendum. You know, just when they changed the referendum, they took that out because, as you say, Max, that's real democracy and it does give the sovereign people back their power. And that's why they're so against it.
Yeah, well, we need to find some way of doing that. Apparently, there's a regulation in England, maybe it's in the Magna Carta or something, where it only takes 10 people per parish to call for a referendum. If you can get 10 people per parish to agree to a referendum on a certain issue, then it goes further from there and you see if the public wants to be involved. But again, this is going back to common law, Magna Carta. Does that have any weight? I mean, can you ever get this through? I mean, we talk about common law as much as we like, but has anyone ever got anywhere with it? You know, that's the question.
Well, yeah, Switzerland have direct democracy like that. They call their own referendums. And in our first constitution, I think you required 50,000 signatures to call a referendum. Now, that may be a bit low in fairness for the population of Ireland right now, but you know, that's only a matter of adjusting the figures. The principle should always be there because... if you take the water meter protest that took place in Dublin, I mean, over 150,000 people took to the streets to say we don't want it and it'll just not be listened to. Where if you had the actual principle of direct democracy in, all you would have had to do was ask the people to sign a form to call a referendum and then there's no need for speeches around. Everybody can go home because you can just have a referendum on it.
Yeah, well, that would be the go. That's what we need, something like that.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, convey this to people in this way would be good, I think, because it's a language that people understand, you know. That's the thing, is trying to get the information to people in a language they can understand. I mean, there's been so much of this, you know, conspiracy culture, if you will, which is
is
so alien to people. And you know, you can point out all of the problems that we've got, but unless you can offer them solutions in a language they can understand, it's not really going to work, you know.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's why myself and Vin, we were just talking earlier on and we were talking about the protest in Dublin. And while a lot of good speakers did get up, a lot of them were just, you know, complaining about the situation in our country, but nobody actually came with a solution. And when the speakers had gone, I was kind of standing there and thought to myself, well, nobody's come with an actual solution. Sure, we all know what the problem is. I mean, if there was a gold medal for complaining, the Irish would win it. So there was no problem there. I wanted to hear a solution.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. We go to these rallies and we think that we've actually made a difference. I mean, it's great for demonstrating solidarity. There are a lot of people in the community who are interested in this same thing, and that's great. But if you're not moving forward from there with a solution, then what is the point of the rally? You know,
yeah, that's right.
They expend their energy and they think they've actually done something and made a difference today, but they haven't. They've just expended their energy and gone home back into complacency, you know.
That's right. And what I would have liked would have been that there would have been forms calling for a referendum on the issue of the water. And then that you march up to the Dáil and you hand it in and you say, here, there's enough signatures. Now go get yourself a referendum.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's finding the issues to get these referendums on as well, you know.
Well, there's enough of them in Ireland.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I hoped the water would do it here in Australia. I really thought fracking would wake up the Australian people. I think, you know, any threat to groundwater, I thought would wake them up. But people are just so busy running on the treadmill that they just don't have time to think about anything like that, unfortunately.
Max, just a minute here on a side issue. Do you have water meters in Australia already?
Water meters, yeah, we've had water meters for years on our houses, yeah.
Okay, right. Sorry, just wanted to double check.
Yeah, we've had water meters for years. Ever since I was a kid, we've had water meters. So, I mean, it's a very, water's a very rare commodity in this country. It's a spring-fed nation. It's a desert nation. So we've always been very, very conscious of water. That's why I thought when they came in and started destroying the groundwater with fracking, it would really wake the Australian people up. But it just hasn't. You know, and it's gotten worse since then. I mean, all the pontificating of this government and the war posturing and everything they're doing now, I mean, it's incredible. We've gone further downhill than I imagined we ever could. in the last 12 months since Tony Abbott's taken office.
You know, it's different, of course, in Ireland. There's no shortage of water here, as you know. In fact, some of our problems trying to get the water away from the homes, they get flooded, and regularly, even in summers, they can get flooded. I know we had a good summer this year, but that wouldn't be the norm. And to think that bottled water is more expensive than petrol in this country is mind-boggling.
Yeah, well, it's because of what they're doing to the water, and what are they doing to the bottled water as well? Maybe it's because everyone's drinking bottled water. Maybe there's too much fluoride in the bottled water, you know. Maybe
I know, I seen, when I was in the United States, I seen Nestle had this water, and they had like a little advertisement on the front of the bottle saying, with added fluoride.
Yeah, great. Just
what they were selling it like that was a good thing, you know.
Yeah, that's just what we want. Isn't that why we're buying the bottled water to begin with? But, you know, it is all of these sorts of things. I mean, it's finding what's going to get people's attention, and then finding what mechanism there is that we can use against the system itself, you know. But we're not going to do any of it without the people. We need the respect of the people. We need an empowered population and people that are willing to act. And that's not going to happen unless they respect each other. So, you know, it's finding some issue that we can bring to people that isn't challenging to them, that won't be causing them to argue and fight amongst each other, something obvious. And, you're saying, well, you know, the only way we can deal with this is by us, you know, instigating community action, you know? So, you know, cause there's been a certain amount of steps that have been, you know, used to bring us to this point. We need to find a way of reversing the sequence. We need to find a way of you know, reversing things and getting people's attention and getting a foot in the door, you know, to begin with. Mm-hmm. I think the money system, the tax system is a way to do it. But again, it's whether these, publicly initiated referendums can happen. You know, it's whether
why, you need to install the principle of direct democracy, because otherwise it's such hard work, say, to even get the water protest going. And then it will fade away, as all the protests do, because people come out and say, oh, well, I went to that one and, you know, I did my bit and blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, when you're in the privacy of your own home and court papers come in suing you because you didn't pay, most people comply. Where if you just made the one step to get direct democracy in, then when there's an issue, there's no more protesting. Imagine in a country, if you had direct democracy, you would never need to protest again. All you need to do is gather signatures. So it really is the answer to whatever the problem may be, and it's the answer, as you were saying, to undo some of the really bad stuff that was already done.
Excuse me, Jeff. Hang on a minute. I want to make a point here. This is where Ireland is really lucky, and where Ben can, where I think Ireland can actually lead the world because of its original constitution. Whereas we don't have the same provisions in the Australian constitution. But if Ireland could get direct democracy, because of its, sort of conflicting constitutions, it could be a world leader.
Yeah, well, that's right. Bill Still was over here and he had never heard of direct democracy before. And I met up with Bill and we did a couple of talks and he was so impressed by the principle of direct democracy. He went home and I know he set up directdemocracy.org and a few other websites, but he did a Still report. I think it's number 88 if anybody wants to see it, the Still report. And it was basically on direct democracy because Bill Still had been talking about fiat currency and government issuing currency instead, and he's been doing it for years. And he said he was no closer to having any government take on his principle about economy than he was when he started. And then he seen direct democracy and he thought, that's the way you do it. You just put it to the people. And if you can present it well to the people, because direct democracy, what we had initiated was that you give as much money and airtime to both sides of the argument, if you like. And then it's just a matter of how well people spend their money rather than, you know, our national TV stations here are so pro-government. I mean, you think you were living in North Korea. So it wouldn't be like that under the direct democracy system. You would have to get equal time and equal money to put your point of view across on a particular issue in a referendum.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, but then again, still tying that, look, this is the thing, like all these, like, for example, the huge protest where you obviously shut down the inner city of Dublin, mm-hmm. on the weekend, and yet there were no solutions. And this is why I keep saying we've got to have the problem, the cause of the problem, the cessation of the problem, and the path leading to the cessation. And I like the fact, Ben, that you talk about the cessation of the problem so much. But I was just wondering, can you, just for Max's sake too, can you sort of, you are a holder of, you have something to do, look, this is very embarrassing. I should have asked Vin privately, but what is your position in terms of sovereign law in Ireland, Ben? You've got some official position there, don't you?
I don't really understand the question of position in sovereign law.
I mean, you represent something. I've forgotten what it is. But maybe I've confused you with some other fellow.
Well, I was the leader of the Direct Democracy Party in this country. And in our first, we stood in a by-election, which was our first election out. And I bet a party that was sitting in government, Labour. Labour came fifth and I came fourth in that particular election. And of course, nobody had ever heard of me before then. So it just goes to show that a lot of people that we could get to. And remember, a lot of these parties are able to get on the TV and spout their wares. And it's the same old crap that people have heard for years. Mm. All we could do was stand in shopping centres and explain what direct democracy was. And when people heard it, they really liked it. And that's why, you know, we gave the government a real shock in that by-election, because we bet a party sitting in government.
Well, that's the point I wanted to make. What was the original Irish constitution that would you like to actually state the actual part of the Irish constitution?
It was Articles 47 and 48 of the original constitution in 1919. And basically all it was that it said the people held the right to initiate referendum. Now, when the government brought out the next constitution, they said the government retained the right of referendum. Of course, they didn't have it to retain in the first place. It belonged with the people. But I'm afraid that's just the way it went. And there was 50,000 votes.
Sorry, just interject there. Sorry, it was Article 28. The people may themselves initiate legislation.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's 28. It was 47 in the second one.
Or by direct vote of 50,000 voters.
Yeah, it was 47 in the second. Sorry, Ben, you're right. But it was 50,000 signatures to initiate. Now, I think there is still a mechanism to initiate a referendum, but it has to be done by the elected representatives. And myself and Vin were talking about, like, you know, when you're elected, you're under a civil servants sort of government that is run by certain agencies, and it's not very democratic. But our forefathers who came out of British oppression, if you like, from hundreds of years, came with a constitution. And I was always telling the people in Ireland that, you know, when your forefathers came from a very oppressive British government, and they were under it for years, hundreds of years and generations, if they put in direct democracy in their very first constitution, that should have been really important, because these guys knew what they wanted and knew what they were doing. And furthermore, then it was taken out of the constitution, but not by referendum. And it wasn't taken out because it was abused, because Ireland actually never called a people-initiated referendum within that time. So it certainly wasn't from abuse. But obviously the powers that be seen that as a huge stumbling block, because if we had direct democracy in this country, we would not have property taxes on our dwellings, on our homes. We would not have water charges. And we certainly would not have bailed out corrupt bankers, which have destroyed this country.
What do you think, Max?
No, it sounds very, very workable. You know, it's interesting that it was in the constitution before and that they took it out. That sort of speaks volumes, really. You know, as far as we go in this country, we don't really even have a valid constitution in this country, but Australia is unique in as much as the original people of this country actually still own the country. This is one of the few places that the Crown actually ever touched that they still have no claim to. There was no war. There was no treaty ever signed. They were just boat people who came here and never left. And if the people of this country were to all treaty with the original people of the country, we could simply kick the Crown out and we could start our own nation. We have the ability to do that in Australia. But there's a huge divide between the the white people in this country and the original people in this country, and even the original people, there's huge divides in the original people. Nobody really knows who the elders are, and nobody really wants to respect each other enough, you know what I mean? Like there's 30 nations that existed in this country, and they've been so convoluted and moved around and everything by the crown. A lot of these people are kind of all mixed up and don't know where they're really from, and you know they don't know who the real elders are and who holds the law, and so it's a really convoluted situation. But you know we can't really look at things from that respect in this country, because this country was founded as a prison colony, and it basically still is. It never really came out of that. Our constitution was never properly ratified. If you really want to look into it, I mean, it's all fiction. Yeah. I think one of the big things about the whole sovereignty movement is that it's been useful in exposing the fiction to people. But even going through all of these things, even with publicly initiated referendums and stuff, unless you've got a lot of the people involved and a lot of the public want to do it, we're assuming that these people who believe they have power over us are going to play by their own rules. And they've already shown us that they're not prepared to do that. You know, so you can get as sovereign as you want. You can go down these free man rabbit holes as much as you want. But as soon as enough people start doing it, well, they've got all the guns and they'll do
it. Yeah, that's right.
You know, unless we've got a strong, respectful community. So that's really where the focus has to be, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Max, because when I was doing this, I said that I wouldn't like to be doing this in the United States or in the UK because, you know, the population for starters was so big compared to our small country. And it's a small country to get around. We are quite a united people in the sense that, you know, we're a very young nation in the sense we came out of British rule only a generation ago, if you like. In fact, we're only coming up to the, in 2 years time to the, centenary of our independence. And, you know, we understand our first constitution. We still have great respect. Our forefathers are not that distant from us. In most cases, they're our grandfathers who would have brought in direct democracy in our first constitution. So, it was a good country to do it in the sense that you're sort of singing to the converted. Everybody sees the problems in this country. It's not like there's two different views on it. I mean, the man in the street and the ordinary guy, all agrees. It's the people in government don't. So it's us and them. So to bring in direct democracy, is a much easier feat than it would be in most countries. And then if people seen it working well in this country, you know, the Brits or whoever else may like to take it on, the Spanish, the Greeks, whoever.
Well, yeah, you know, if it can be initiated and be transparent enough, and you need to have a really honest and informed media, you know, and your people really have to have access to information for something like direct democracy to work. But I mean, it's a stepping stone. You know, all these things are stepping stones. Anything we can do to undermine this system in a peaceful manner and put power back in the hands of the people, I think is a good thing. Anything we can use to get people's attention in a manner that they can understand is a good thing. And there is no easy fix. There is no new system we need to construct or put in place, I don't think. We simply need to exercise the power that we've got. And I, you know, with all of these new systems that people offer us, I don't think we need any of it. I think this system is salvageable if we were to change our own mindset. You know, if people, change the way they interact with other people and change the way they interact with society in general and don't deviate from their moral compass, then the system has to change with us. You know, if we could operate out of respect for each other and do what's right, don't abide any legislation which causes you to deviate from your moral compass, and don't support an economic model that is going to make human life expendable in order to support the economic system. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. And we've got a system based in permanent growth. So the only result of this system will be to turn the entire world into a rubbish tip. That's the only possible result of this system.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. It's designed to destroy the planet. And if we're going to allow the planet to be destroyed and allow humanity to be discarded in order to support an economic model, then we deserve what we get. So we've got to stop and start questioning this sort of stuff and question any legislation or any rule that's been put in place which causes us to deviate from our moral compass or that makes humankind expendable. But if we don't stand up and question it, then where will it go from there? If we don't question it, then who's to blame?
Yeah, that's right. And that's why when we were knocking on the doors, you know, some of the older generation were saying to us, well, you know, we'll vote for, you know, whoever because it's better. They're the lesser of two evils and things like that. I used to always say, well, you know, if you vote for the lesser of two evils, you still end up with evil and, you know, it's not really good enough.
Exactly. I just say, look, I won't vote until there's a suitable candidate. Because there are only suitable candidates and I refuse to support organized crime. It's as simple as that. And if you want me to go to court, well, okay, let's go and talk about it. Let's do it publicly. Because I'm happy to discuss this in front of the whole country. You know?
Well, I gave up voting when I was 21, which was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, me too. I hadn't voted since I was 18.
Well, I never put myself on the electoral roll. I've just never voted. I've never seen anything.
Yeah.
Supporting in this system.
But you see, I always said, like, because I stopped voting when I was 18. I think I voted when I was 18 and then stopped because I just wanted to see what it was like. But, you know, in our country, and it's probably like the same, you vote left or right or, you know, whatever. And I mean, it was just, you're either voting Tweedledum or Tweedledee and they all promise you something. They all just basically run the country for their own benefits and not for the people. So I don't blame anybody not voting, but unfortunately that doesn't change the system either. So,
well,
but as you say, there's no point voting for the system that you're trying to destroy, if you like, or change at least, you know.
Well, we've got to find a mechanism with which to put the power back in the hands of the people. I mean, maybe that is by voting. Maybe it's by standing up and not voting. I mean, if the whole country refused to vote, maybe it would send a message there.
Yeah.
And the beauty of something like Ireland is that it's a small enough country, like you say. It's like, it's a big village.
Right.
It's a big community.
That's all, yeah.
We haven't got that here in Australia. We're all spread out over an area twice the size of Europe. So it's very hard to unite these people.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why I say, like, to try to get people not to vote was much harder than just asking them to give you even your second preference vote. Because even if we got one person in to the Dáil or into our government, you know, then they get press coverage and they can keep talking about direct democracy. And then you get the message out because you can then slag off other politicians who are against democracy, you know, direct democracy, because basically what they're saying is if you have a politician, a voted politician who's against direct democracy, what he's actually telling is the people is, I don't think you should have a say. I think you should do as I say.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And it's a great demonstration to people of how corrupt the system is. So it's a useful tool, you know.
But that's why I think it's really important for us to try to get at least one member into government, because he can keep raising that issue. And then anytime there's an issue like property tax or water charges or bailing out the bondholders, he's just going to be repeating the same old mantra. I think we should let the people decide.
Well, yeah, that might reach people. You know, the thing is, we need to do it quickly because we're running out of time. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, listen, I've hogged your show enough, and I want to get on and let you guys talk away. So I'll bow out. Max, great to talk to you again. Liz, talk to you soon.
No worries, Ben. Good to talk to you again.
No butter. Bye, bye, bye.
Thank you so much for coming, Ben.
No butter.
Well, so look, I really, 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 I'm only, as I've told you before, Max, I'm feeling my way in terms of politics and having disengaged from voting. You know, the first time I voted, I lived in Toorak. Well, you can imagine what my vote was worth then. So I voted for the marijuana party, even though I didn't smoke marijuana, because I thought it was the most shocking thing I could do, because, you know, it was such a right-wing suburb. And then the second time that I voted was when they kicked old Goff out, you know, which was a pretty amazing thing. Did you understand when they kicked Goff out what that was about?
Not really at the time, no. I didn't at the time. I didn't, wasn't that much involved in politics at the time. I just couldn't quite figure it out. I knew that he wanted to kick the CIA out of the country and he wanted access to Pine Gap. And so I knew he wasn't going to last very long.
He was a very powerful leader. He was a very powerful, you know, like he was a bit, well, he's a very powerful man. And what was quite hilarious was the way that he and Malcolm Fraser became really strong allies in humanitarian efforts after they resigned from politics.
Yeah, that was an interesting turn of affairs, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then now Malcolm Fraser's really against Tony Abbott, who's the leader of the same party, saying he's the most sneaky, creepy man you could ever possibly have, which is completely true. But anyway, bringing it back to Ireland and direct democracy, because once I discovered the idea of citizens-initiated referendum, like I saw Ben Gilroy and Vin were talking about it, and then I started really looking into what was happening in Switzerland and talking to a friend of mine who's actually a policy writer for the Liberal Party, Timothy Warner, or he was. I think he's doing something with them again at the moment and hearing all his arguments against direct democracy. But the more I looked into it, the arguments for direct democracy are so much more what we want because, yeah, and this is where it tied in with what you said. We're now, short conversation the other day, which was that we really need to have, let the people have a say and have more referendums. And it seems a shame that we're so busy focusing on the problem that we're not focusing on the solution. And the solution really is, one, to have our say. And the other thought that I have is people need to be educated. And a third thought, you know, because it'll make us all work harder to influence each other, and give each other intelligent arguments if we're going to, be in referendums, be more involved in our politics rather than handing it over to a bad parent.
Well, the thing is, it gets people involved and it's in a language I understand, but again, you'd have to have a really informed population for direct democracy to work, which means you need to have an honest media, which we don't have at the moment. Unfortunately, you know, the world is very, very influenced by the media, especially in this country. People just believe their televisions tell them. So in the current climate, would it work, you know? But if you can present the concept to people that actually they should have a say in what's going on and the concept of publicly initiated referendums and use it as a means of addressing things such as the tax system or the fracking or the wars or whatever, I mean, find out what it is that's going to get people's attention quickly enough, which is usually their hip pocket. So tax or money is usually the best way to go. And if we can, okay, here's a way of changing the tax system. Here's three or four simple steps we can use to do it, which would suddenly put everybody in a state where they've got much more time, they've got much more money, and we can do this by a publicly instituted referendum. Something like that. Present it to people in a really easy way that they can understand and you might get their attention. You know, but we're seriously running out of time. We need to find a means of which to put the power back in the hands of the people, or at least get them to realize that they actually do have power. They actually do have the ability to stand up and make a difference. And that there is a mechanism there that we can do it. It's called democracy. You know, we can actually use this as a mechanism to get back to something a little bit more decent, you know. But we've got to do something about this government. We've got to do something about this system. Especially this little cretin we've got in power here at the moment. It's no wonder that Malcolm Fraser doesn't like Tony Abbott. I mean, anybody who's able to think doesn't like Tony Abbott. Tony Abbott's like some sort of genetic mutation. I don't know where they got this guy from, but he's like Gollum on steroids or something.
Yeah, with a couple of budgies shoved, or one budgie shoved down the front of his Speedos.
Yeah, I don't know. He's a disgusting little individual, absolute sociopath, and all this war posturing against the Middle East and flexing his muscles and trying to get in there and bombing raids. And I mean, he's a disgusting creature. He really is.
He really is. And this is what's really interesting because he thinks he's a Christian, and that helps me segue to where another place I wanted to go with you. And what I was thinking about when you were talking with Ben earlier, and that was that we're coming out of a seriously top-down religious attitude too, you know, like with Christianity and the Bible and the churches and the way they've ruled us and, you know, tied in with the Vatican, which, what was it, 1301? The Vatican took control of the world more or less, didn't it?
1302 with the Unum Sanctum Trust. You know, he calls himself a Christian, but he's not a Christian. I mean, he's not a Christian at all. It's like, you know, like all these religious overtones to everything we see in the world these days, like this ISIS terrorist group, their media is labeling them as Islamic militants. Well, they're not Islamic militants at all. They're not Islamic extremists at all. I mean, they're partying, they're killing women and children, they're drinking, you know, where's any of this in the Quran? You know, they're just extremists. They're just militants. They're not Islamic militants. There's no reason to put a religious overtone to it at all. Even if they're calling themselves Islamic, they're not. Yes.
But that's how daft we have become, because that's the lack of intelligence. That's the religious education that our people have had. That has been nothing to do.
Even Tony Abbott, though, Tony Abbott only calls himself a Christian for the Christian people out there to try to fool them into thinking that he is a Christian. He knows he's not a Christian. He knows he's a sociopath, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah, but the little dweeb did go to a seminary and try to become a priest for a little while.
Well, it's pretty like, he probably likes feeling up little boys, you know? Probably why he did that. I wouldn't put it past him, you know?
But it doesn't mean you get true religion. You know what I mean? This is the thing. You can go to all of these places. I mean, you might get religion, but you don't get true spiritual realization.
No.
Yeah. So that's, I haven't got control of my Sam, so I can't play any of the songs I was going to play because, anyway, it doesn't matter. So Vin might place a song soon, but he's on the phone at the moment to Ben Gilroy by the look of things. So it says in the chat box here, but, look, let's just stick with that for a minute. Max, you had a profound, just going slightly sideways, but tie it to sovereignty, tie it to democracy, tie it to people initiated referendum. You did have some sort of realization, I saw in one of the YouTube videos I watched on you, in which you sort of realized your own sovereignty in a very profound way. Could you put that in terms that you...
Well, that was a real connecting experience I had in a meditation where I realized I was connected to everything else. The thing with sovereignty is that I believe we're already sovereign. We're all sovereign already. Everybody is. You know, if the system is claiming you're not, then the system needs to provide you with proof of that claim. You know, we go through all of these different steps to try to find our way through this maze, through this quagmire to establish our freedom. We think that we can find a piece of paper, we can sign these forms, we can send our birth certificate back, we can do this, we can lose the name, you know, lose the name, win the game, all this sort of stuff. You know, well, you're not free if you lose the name. You're free when they stop asking you for the name. And that won't be until everybody wakes up to the fact that this system's fiction. You know, so, you know, I'm of the attitude that we're already sovereign. We already are.
We are.
There's no doubt about that.
But we're not teaching our children that, right? We're regimenting our children. And so I think a lot of the sort of transformation has to take place in the individual in recognizing our sovereignty and the so-called New Age movement, which means 1,000 different things to 1,000 different people. And it's so full of crap and it's so full of good things, you know. Like I thought the New Age movement was, you know, starting to become philosophical and understand your own true nature and recognizing how divine you are and recognizing the divine nature in others and all acting with some sort of respect for the other, because you get such enormous respect for yourself, you know, when you do meditate and know your true nature. But that conversation almost needs to be sort of one of the foundation stones for us to change society, is for us to disconnect from, like you say, the fictions and the things that television and the media are telling us and reconnect the way that we relate.
Well, it's all the stuff that these people learn in this New Age stuff. They don't apply it to the world. A lot of these people are fake. They're just fake. They read these books and they try to feel this way, but they don't actually feel that way. And they don't actually apply it to their lives. And they believe because they've done all these sort of self-help things and they've got all the right spiritual airs that they're better than other people, and they become narcissistic about it. And it becomes spiritual narcissism. That's what the New Age movement's designed to do. It gives people 90% of the truth and then locks them in these bubbles of inaction and narcissism. And that's exactly what it's for. That's what it's been all about the whole time. You know? I mean, people just don't apply themselves to the world, unfortunately. They don't, you know? They just learn all this stuff. Well, you apply yourself. Apply yourself to the world and question authority. Question authority in the right way. You know, don't deviate from your moral compass. And if you're required to deviate from your moral compass, ask why. Ask why the system would require you to do something which is essentially immoral, something which is damaging to humankind. Why are these regulations in place? You know, you need to ask these questions. We need to ask them, all ask them in the right way. And again, you've got to become friends with people. You've got to become friends with your community, because when you start asking these questions, you want the people around you to be nodding and going, yeah. What he said, we're asking these questions too. Because if the whole community's asking the questions, then the system has to back down. you know. Mm-hmm. And even the people that are operating within the system, that think the system's real, will start questioning why they're doing what they're doing. You know, the thing is that people are programmed. The whole system, it's like an organism. It's like a life force of its own, and it gets its energy from the people who work within it who believe that it's real. You know, so we have to reach these people in a reachable way, in a reasonable way, in a respectful way, a way that's going to work. You know, because not all the people who work within the system are psychopaths. There are psychopaths who put the system in place. There are psychopaths who work at the top of the system, but not all the people who work within it are psychopaths. You know, they're often programmed, often very confused, and they're doing what they can to try to find a way through life. So you've got to try to be respectful to these people and realize, you know, you can't hate them. They're doing what they're doing because they're programmed. Of course they are. And why else would they be doing it, you know? And so it's finding that mechanism. It's finding what we can use to empower the community around us and become friends with people. If we're not going to become friends with people, we can sit here and shake our fist and scream and go to protests all we want. But if we're not going to become friends with people, then what's the point? I mean, when we've got all these protests and these marches, how many contacts do we make there? Or do we get into arguments with people? Are we actually making contacts and building some strong communal response? You know, because otherwise what's it all about, you know? So.
I'm just laughing because people on people's internet radio. Oh, no, I don't think I'll tell the story yet. Oh, look, actually, I sort of get a fair bit of currency because I'm a shock jock. The last protest I went to ended up having a brief fling with somebody from the protest. So you do make contact sometimes. But it wasn't the last protest. It was years ago. Anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is, with those contacts, it's something that Paul, Cienfuegos, the guy who's, the American guy who uses the American Constitution, for community, empowerment. I sent you, a link on him. I don't know whether you had time or bothered to look at it, but it's about the community rights movement in America. And, what he says is exactly what you just said, Max, is that we use an enormous amount of energy, in a protest, which shows how passionate people are and how much they feel about it. But then at the same time, that energy is then dissipated again. Whereas if we could, and as Ben Gilroy just said, if we could actually harness that energy and keep it going, because we have to protest against fracking, we have to protest against oil, we have to protest against all these different things. Whereas if we had direct democracy or a citizens-based referendum, it would be the click of a button in the new age world, in which we can just put in our vote, and also then we gradually change the rights, you know, like we have rights of nature and we have community rights in place, then we wouldn't have to this enormous amount of energy that people actually have, like they have for the right, you know, water rights in Ireland, could become a permanent, and we wouldn't dissipate that energy. That energy would be harnessed, and it would build and build and build from the grassroots up.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, things like protests in that respect are counterproductive because they do dispel energy. And they're also, I mean, the government always encourages us to protest if we don't like what's going on. Why do they encourage us to protest? Well, it's because they can measure the response. Well, they can measure the communal response to any situation. They can go and listen to the talks. Okay, nobody's providing any solutions here. They get to see where the current state of human consciousness is and our current understanding of the situation is. They get to see how many people in the community are actually willing to get out and march. And they see where we are. So it's kind of a way of gauging whether, you know, how much they're getting away with, you know?
Yeah, that's a part of it. It's a part of it. It's not the whole of it, but that's a part of it that, you know, it can be measured that way of the pressure group. And if it was a reflexive government, then, and it was close to an election, then it would make more difference, wouldn't it?
Well, to a degree. To a degree. I mean, you know, we saw the protests in London recently for Gaza. 300,000 people at one stage protesting in London, two blocks from the BBC, and it wasn't even on the BBC. So the media, I don't know whether you're going to get much out of the media, you know.
But thank God we've got, you know, internet now and Facebook and things like that. But it's still not enough. It's only the beginning, you know. And this is the thing. I think we can, you know, like I've been hearing about the Illuminati for the last 30 years and the Bones Club and, you know, have people come and, well, longer than, yeah, about 30 years and people come and chew my ear on it and all of that. And, but I haven't really been hearing a lot about solutions.
Well, no, that's the thing. I mean, and a lot of that is what, that's what all of that's about. I mean, even talk about the Illuminati, and I've gone down that rabbit hole for quite a long time. Even talk about all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's the spy novel version of reality, and it becomes quite intriguing to know that there's this shadow hand behind all the, you know, this all powerful hand behind the mechanism that you can't see, all this sort of stuff. And it also makes these people appear to be far more powerful than they actually are. Because they're only as powerful as what we believe they are. And if you believe there is this shadowy hand out there and there's nothing you can do about it, well, then you're completely disempowered. And all they have to do is have their hand in a few movie companies and stuff and make sure their logos get put everywhere, and you'll think they're all powerful, you know. And that's the way they've done it, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Now, that's the thing that you, Vin, and Ben are all working on, and I believe you've made quite a few films, Max, and that is working on doing some sort of more film thing, because film does seem to be a really good way to get to people. Well, it's the way I study. I study a lot on YouTube.
Well,
you know,
I
like to watch in aesthetic.
Well, TV is what's brainwashed a lot of people. People sit there, they're used to it. They sit there and they watch this stuff. They like moving images. They like films. So, and we know it works. We know it's programmed a lot of people. So perhaps we can use it to deprogram them. So yeah, I've made 6 films. I'm halfway through making another one. I had intended to go back to Gaza Strip. I was actually going to leave tomorrow and go and make another documentary in Gaza as well. But now I'm having, now that I've finally actually got access to Gaza, which has taken me ages to actually get access in there, I'm finding that journalists are being detained when they're going across the Sinai and they're having their cameras removed from them. So now I've got another snag. There's no point in me doing a 16-hour flight to Cairo, actually a 19-hour flight to Cairo, in order to catch a cab across the Sinai and get my camera confiscated as soon as I hit Suez Canal. So I have to find another way.
There might be some in there. There might be some in Gaza. You'll probably be able to buy them when you get in there, Max. What about that?
Difficult to get cameras in Gaza Strip. A lot of people that I know in Gaza are always asking if you could bring cameras in. So, and, you know, it's just difficult at the moment. I'm trying to negotiate with some other people to find another way in. At least I've got the ticket there now. I mean, the ticket's already, it's a floating ticket. So I've got this, you know, the person who sponsored my ticket to Cairo and back. This is a floating ticket. So at least I can, if I can arrange safe travel from Cairo to Gaza, then I can do it. But at the moment it's just too uncertain. There's not any real point in trying at the moment. It's just too uncertain, you know.
Well, this is a thing, you know, that I quite like to discuss, and that is Gaza, because saying, and I have read, that half the population of the Gaza Strip, which is only 25 miles long, you know, it is a gulag, are children. And you want to make a film about that, don't you, Max?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really do. I think people need to understand what's going on in Gaza, and it is. It's like a modern-day version of the Warsaw Ghetto. It really is. It's the world's largest open-air prison, and the population is over half children. You know, when Israel is saying they're having a war against this population, they're actually having a war against children. So, yeah, people need to pay attention to that.
Do you want to extrapolate on that a little bit when you say they're having a war against children?
Well, there's 900,000 children. You've got an area that's 4.5 miles wide and 25 miles long, 1.8 million people. It's walled in. It's a walled in population, and there's over 900,000 children. So over half the population is children. You know, so you're having a war against children, really. And they're saying, oh, look, you know, Hamas are using people as human shields and stuff like this. Well, it's the most densely populated area on Earth. If they're fighting back at all, then there are civilians around them where they're fighting back. You know, there's no way you can do anything in Gaza where there aren't civilians around. It's just like 3,000 people per square mile in Gaza Strip. It's one of the most densely populated areas on Earth. So, you know, and 900,000 children, over half the population is children. So you're going and conducting air raids against this population, bombing them for 51 days. They're walled in. They can't run anywhere. They can't fight back. You know, they don't have an army. I mean, it takes two armies to have a war for a start. Gaza doesn't have an army. It's a population mainly of children. So where's the army in amongst here? Where's the weapons? They don't have any weapons. They have these little Qassam rockets, these fertilizer-powered pipes that they send over the wall. They have light weapons. They have, you know, Kalashnikovs and handguns and stuff, and rocks and stones. And they're fighting against one of the most powerful military machines on Earth, which is using aerial bombardment. Gaza doesn't have any anti-aircraft guns or anything like that. How do you fight aerial bombardment and tanks and all of this sort of stuff? It's absurd. It's ethnic cleansing and genocide. It's absolutely outrageous. And it's not war at all, not war in any stretch of the imagination. It's brutal terrorism that is carried out against the people of Gaza, and yet they slander the people in Gaza by labeling them as terrorists while they do it. It's absolutely
This is what's so shocking. It's just ridiculous to label children as terrorists, and they do. They give that image all around the world, don't they? They show little child soldiers with guns, of which there's probably about three guns.
Well, you know, they probably set kids up, and I mean, God knows. And what, how many kids are we seeing like this? You know, you see one or two. You know, I mean, I've seen lots of, Israeli children, training as soldiers as well, playing with Uzis, little 3-year-old girls playing with bazookas. I mean, does this mean all of the Israeli children are training as soldiers, you know, at that age? Of course not. You know, you can just look at these photographs and you can spin it any way you want. It's like a lot of the news stories we see on TV, so many staged news stories. You get a bunch of militant-looking people marching down a street, and they tell you anything they want to tell you about it. So, you know, you've got to go out and see the world for yourself and go and visit these places for yourself. Go and visit Palestine. Go and meet the people there. I mean, these aren't bad people. These are good people caught in a living hell, and the world needs to pay attention to it.
So that's the situation. So what I have to say about all of this is we really do have to concentrate on knowing ourselves, recognizing our own loveliness and recognizing that in the other and bringing the best out in other people. And because, yes, we've got a problem, but we don't want to be like those dogs that Professor Martin Seligman made his first lot of fame. Which was from electrocuting dogs, and the dogs got so used to being electrocuted that they didn't even bother moving off the mat. And hello, John.
Oh yeah.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. I was just sitting back listening and looking at the chat box. Lots of conversations going on. Yeah. Enjoying listening to Max.
Yeah.
I really want to hear more about what's actually happening there in Gaza.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's gone off the radar screen as regards Facebook even, you know. Never mind
really,
the TV.
It has. We just forget it, don't we?
Yeah, it's like only a couple of months ago, everybody was posting up horrific photographs of mutilated children. And they held some peace talks. And next of all, sure, it's not even newsworthy anymore. Except there's some...
Getting your arms and legs blown off must bloody hurt. Oh, it's just horrendous. You know, like, it's always shocked me, the thought of, you know, even every war I ever hear of, I always just imagine some child with a limb blown off or, you know, like the agony, the torture that we put people through. It's just insanely vicious and, just ghastly.
Well, you can imagine those young children and families living through all that, seeing it every day for however long it lasted there during the summer. And it beggars belief now that it's just gone completely away from any sort of media. And nobody can understand what's going on. That was as soon as they stopped the ceasefire, or had the ceasefire, it was a news blackout, which I don't think that would suit the people in Palestine, or the Palestinian people, the people in Gaza, very much, because it takes the eye away from them, whereas the eye of the world was on them. And I think a lot of people decided that they were going to stop drinking Coca-Cola and maybe stop shopping and, you know, boycotting a few places that had to do with Israel may have had a significant factor in taking the stop, you know.
Sorry, darling. What? Yeah, we've got Max. Max is back. And even Vin's apologizing.
That's all good. Welcome. Yeah, look, it's interesting that the media blackout on Gaza. I mean, a lot of people in the internet are still paying attention. I was actually supposed to go into Gaza tomorrow, but I'm still trying to negotiate safe passage across the Sinai because you can't get cameras in there. I mean, Gaza's been under siege since 2007, and Israel just doesn't let that sort of stuff in, you know. A lot of friends of mine are asking me to bring cameras in with me when I come for them because they'd like cameras. So that's the problem, is that there's people that are having their cameras confiscated in the Sinai. There's a lot of kidnaps happening in the Sinai as well. It's just kind of red flagged as an area that you just don't go to at the moment. So the problem is that the government in Egypt at the moment is a military junta. It's not a democracy. And so the people that got us in last time had a little bit of pull with the police and stuff, so that if there was a problem, they had a little bit of influence with the police. They probably could have got us out of any situation. But at the moment, with military in control of the checkpoints going across the Suez, they're just confiscating cameras and this sort of stuff. And because I'm not Palestinian, I'm a foreigner, so they scrutinise me a little bit more, and they're giving foreign journalists a particularly difficult time crossing the Sinai at the moment. And so a couple of skinny white guys going across there with a few thousand dollars worth of camera equipment, you're not going to make it past the first checkpoint. It's a given. And that's what I'm told by friends of mine over there. They've said, look, if you can, you'd have to make your camera look like it's broken. Like take the battery cover off and separate the lenses and this sort of stuff and just try to, you know. But, you know,
I reckon find a camera in there. There's got to be cameras in there. There will be cameras in there.
Well, there'll be some sort of cameras in there, darling, but what sort of cameras will they be? And then the fact that there's a lot of people being kidnapped across the Sinai at the moment as well, it's just, it's not a good, I'm not feeling good about going there at the moment. So to do such a long trip, and risk camera theft and possibly kidnapping, I mean, this is not constructive. No. I mean, there's a way to do things and there's a way not to do things. At least I've got the ticket there. I'm ready to go. It's all paid for. I can go any time an opening goes that I can get in. But there's other options at the moment. There's a boat maybe going in from Turkey. There's a few other options. There are aid shipments that are going in there from Kuwait and places like this. So there is other options. If I can find some sort of legitimate organization to travel across the Sinai with, so I'm not just a white guy in a cab. I mean, you know, a couple of white guys in a cab traveling across northern Sinai is just stupid at this particular stage, you know. With the current political situation in the northern Sinai, it's just asking for trouble. So
why is it? Why? How the hell did this happen? I mean, like, how did they end up, like, why do you think they put up the bloody wall?
Why did they put up the wall?
Yeah.
Because they want them all dead. They want them all to go away. There's many ways of ethnic cleansing a population. One way is to prevent movement of the population. To prevent them moving, just cut them off. Cut them off from the outside world, and they'll slowly deteriorate and they'll slowly die. Within another 10 years, Gaza will be so polluted you won't be able to live there anyway. You know, simply because it's cut off. No water's allowed to flow in. They actually worked out how many calories the people of Gaza need, and that's how many supplies they would allow in. Okay?
It's horrendous. It's
ethnic cleansing. That's why the wall's there. That's why the wall's around Jerusalem as well. Yeah, they're not allowed to build any new homes. They won't allow all, and there's a whole, like, truckloads of building supplies to go into Gaza, and Israel won't let them in. So I know they may use them for building tunnels. We've just blown up 11,000 homes and made 400,000 people homeless, but we're not allowing any building supplies in there because it may be a threat to Israel. You know, it's ethnic cleansing. It's ethnic cleansing. That's why they do everything that they've done.
Yeah, it's totally and utterly ethnic cleansing. And who owns the military there? You know, who runs the military? It's
who
back
runs?
To the, yeah, like, I mean, you know, you can't go across the Sinai because there's military, there's military. There's
well,
military,
that's Egypt. That's the Egyptian military is in control of the Sinai at the moment. But the Sinai is a very lawless region. And it's just, you know, I've been trying to get safe passage across the Sinai. That's been the big concern for me. Because the thing is, I'm taking a young cameraman in with me. And, you know, I don't want to be walking into the lion's den with this young guy. He's never been to Gaza before. So, I mean, it's one thing for me to be taking risks going certain places, but when I've got someone else that I'm responsible for, I need to have some sort of a guarantee of safe passage. You know, or at least not be taking risks that are like too in your face. I mean, the situation there at the moment is very, very unstable. I know for a fact, I've heard from friends of mine that at least three foreign journalists have been detained and arrested and had their camera equipment taken from them at the Suez crossing. I know this for a fact because I was speaking to someone the other day, and I know for a fact that the government, when you get to the Suez Sinai crossing, even the people who got me transported across the Sinai last time said they can only get me as far as that crossing because they can't guarantee what will happen when I get to that crossing, because it doesn't matter whether I've got papers or whatever, the military will take me out of the vehicle, they will search all my possessions, and they will confiscate any working cameras that I have, you know?
Yeah.
And if they do let me through, then, you know, there's a chance that they may not even let me through because of the fact that my life is in danger if I go past that point, because there's a lot of kidnappings happening in the Northern Sinai. So they've destabilized the entire region. So it's very, very difficult for people like me to actually get into Gaza, even if I want to. You know, and you've got to look at all this and we'll weigh up the possibilities. Okay, well, what do? Do I just go there and catch a cab on spec? That I'm going to get across the Northern Sinai with the camera and get into Gaza Strip. And then I've got to get out of Gaza Strip and get back with this footage that I've just taken. You know, so are they going to let me bring footage back out? That's another thing. So there's a lot of things to weigh up. And, you know, is it viable to go and do this, or is it simply stupid to go and do it? And at the present climate, it just doesn't seem like a sensible or a rational thing to do. And for me to take a young guy in there with me is irresponsible, I think, you know.
You know, what it makes me think about is, like, I don't know if I've just gone into pessimist mode or what, but I'd be getting a boat out of Gaza. You know, like, why isn't everybody just leaving and just getting out of there and giving them their bloody...
They tried getting a boat out of Gaza, but they don't want to give up their country anyway. But they did try. I mean, there was boats of refugees left, and they were washed up in Turkey, and Israel shot one boat out of the water. They said, no, they just sank, but it's speculated that Israel actually shot one boat of refugees out of the water. Wouldn't surprise me that they would do that. There's been people trying to get out, and it's very difficult. I mean, there's Israeli gunships off the coast of Gaza patrolling the 6-mile limit. They haven't let them leave. You know, they're surrounded under siege by land, sea, and air, and it's been for 7 years.
How long is that going to keep that up? They make themselves look terrible. Why is it going on? Like, why does...
They'll keep it up until they own all of Gaza Strip, and they'll keep doing settlements in the West Bank until they own all of West Bank. They'll keep going until there is no more Palestine. That's the plan. It always has been. And once they've done that, then they'll continue to expand into the surrounding countries. That's also the plan, the Greater Israel Project.
God. And I grew up so pro-Israel and so pro-Jewish, and... Yeah, we used to get the Jewish news and, feel sorry for what the Germans did. And now, and it's not a matter of Judaism. It's a, It's actually a matter of having internalized the oppressor, I suppose, in a lot of ways. You know, like if you, it's like children who are reared by pedophiles can become pedophiles. It seems to me like these people have been so abused that they've now become the abuser. And, you know, what happened before that? It's just this intergenerational abuse that's just going on and on and on and on and on.
Well, it's terrible, the abuse that they're actually subject to, the programming they're subject to. You know, it's the victim mentality that's instilled into the people of Israel. You know, they're trained to believe that they're victims and that the world wants to kill them. So they're instantly on the defensive all the time, like they're attacking in self-defense all the time. Mm. When there is no threat, there is no threat. People don't hate the Jews. People don't want to kill them. But they're trained to believe that we do. The whole world does, which is really unfortunate. Yep. And that creates the situation that you see in Israel today. You know, I mean, all of the aggression that Israel's carried out against its neighbors that it's been doing for the last 67 years has all been done in the name of self-defense. And none of it has been self-defense. It's just this victim mentality that's been bred into the people. That's a program. It's just very unfortunate. But that's what happens. When you get, you're told you're the victim and you get programmed to believe you're a victim, then you're instantly on the defensive all the time. You're expecting everything to be an attack, and so you're instantly attacking everybody else. And that's just the way it's gone, you know.
And that brings us back to what we were saying before in terms of solutions. It's a matter of recognizing your own beautiful nature and recognizing that beautiful nature in the other, and then learning skills and techniques and, you know, developing relationships of trust, which is really hard to do when you're busy blowing people up and you're busy being blown up.
Well, this is what I've tried to present to people, you know, discover your own perfection, because once you discover that, you can get rid of all the religious overtones and all the ethnic overtones and all this other stuff. And if you want to have religious beliefs, that's fine, have them. But don't see them as a reason to be divided from other people or different from other people or disrespectful to other people. You know, that's not what any religion's about, I don't believe. I think all religions have they say that they're about peace. Why don't we see that from them, you know? I ultimately believe that religions actually have a seed of supremacism in them as well. All religions seem to do this because all religions teach you that their way is the right way. And to me, that is supremacist. I think there's a seed of beauty in all of them. And they should learn to get along with each other and put all this stuff aside. I mean, if you want to have that. But ultimately, why do you need it? Why can't you just see the perfection of yourself and see that in others and honor others? You know, if you could do that, then, we'd have the solution to the whole thing straight away, you know.
Yeah, and then some of the teenagers, you know, and a lot of the Israelis are marching against this war, but they're just getting absolutely nowhere. Teenagers of Israel love Palestine, and Palestine loves Israel. You know, they have all these friendship groups where they come together and they have dialogue and they talk about it. But even though what they're having to say is far more intelligent than the powers that be, in inverted commas, it's still not breaking the pattern.
Well, no, it won't. And, you know, it's a shame, but it won't. I mean, it's such a convoluted issue, the whole Israel-Palestine issue. But, you know, I don't see how the peace process is ever going to work. It's not going to work until Israel acknowledges Palestine's right to exist, and it won't do that. And until Israel acknowledges Palestine's right to exist, there'll be no peace. There never will be any peace, you know.
But didn't Palestine get there first? This is all about Jesus got born in Bethlehem or something, wasn't it? Like,
well,
how did they get so confused?
It's pretty convoluted. It's pretty convoluted, but it was Palestine. It was divided back in 1948, but
it's no longer.
Now there is no Palestine on the maps, and Israel will tell you that there never was a Palestine, and it'll claim that the problem with the Palestinian peoples is that they won't acknowledge Israel's right to exist. But Israel does exist, and it won't acknowledge Palestine's right to exist. That's the problem, you see. That's why the peace process has always failed. There were 7 million people made refugees when Israel was formed. There were, you know, so many, there was a massive amount of ethnic cleansing and people driven out of their homes, and it was absolutely brutal what happened to the Palestinian people, and it's never acknowledged as being part of the peace process when it's actually the cause of the problem. That is the cause
of
the entire
negation. That's the negation of the binary, the me and not me. Right? Yeah. That's what we do. That's the narcissistic view, which some people call patriarchy, in terms of the binary of there's me and there's not me. Some sociologists call that othering, but it's very much about me and not me, and that's exactly what's happening there. So to overcome that narcissistic wound, which is obviously what it is, because we're born, you know, recognizing our interconnection, then what do you do? I suppose you have to go through a whole lot of...
Well, you know, you've got to try to put down your ethnic pride and put down your patriotism and put down your ethnic heritage, whatever it is you believe it is, and put down the borders of these countries and stuff, and put down all this fictional stuff we've created, because ultimately it's all a construct, really, isn't it? All these borders, and they're not there. If you go out and look at the ground, there's no border there. We drew that on a map, you know. It's a construct. All of these things are constructs. The whole my part on the earth is better than your part on the earth. The whole concept that you can actually own a part of the earth and you can have an actual country is you know, these are all constructs. I mean, if people could put all this stuff down and just get along with each other, then things would be very different. It's finding a way that people will do that, you know.
Yeah, and that brings it back to the way that we educate our children and to our parenting skills. And, you know, like right now, if, you know, the one thing that we can do, that I can do right now, is brainwash my grandchild.
Well, unbrainwash him, you know, like in lead by example in what you do. Have an honest perspective of reality and apply it to the world that you live in, and help that rub off on other people. Teach your children to be objective, to always view things from an objective perspective, you know what I'm saying? I mean, like, you can't hold your kids back. I mean, people say, oh, homeschooling and stuff. Well, it's important that kids go out and interact with other kids, and it's important that they see how the mechanism works, but it's important that you educate them as well on what that mechanism is and what they're being fed at school and how to, how to really look at it and why they shouldn't place too much emphasis on what they're learning at school and how their exams don't really mean that much. You know, it's all to do with programming and indoctrination. You can help them see this in an early age, but you can still help them see a need to find a way through it. You can make it work for yourself. You can get these letters behind your name. Just realize that the more letters you get behind your name, the more programmed you are. That's what it's all about. Even university, one verse, one way of thinking, you know, that's what it's all about. So just help the kids understand this along the way. Help them become observers of the world as they go through it. And that'll make a difference, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. Look, my son was lucky enough, my youngest son, well, lucky enough, his smart mother took him there. My son didn't like, I had a dream, right? Just personalize this for a second. I had a dream one night that my son, he'd been in the school for 6 weeks. We moved to Queensland. You might know Udlo and Mooloola around the Sunshine Coast, inland from Caloundra there, Max.
Yeah, I know Mooloola.
Yeah. Well, we were in Mooloola. We moved to, Mooloola, and, I had my son in this school, and he'd been there for 6 weeks, and he was in grade two. And I had a dream that there were these two witches sitting around a spit, roasting a puppy on the spit, because they wanted the crackling of his fat, and the puppy was still alive. And I thought, oh, shivers, that's my son, Freeman. He's having a hard time at school. And he hadn't actually told me. And so that day I went out and checked out these other schools, and there happened to be one in Shevelum, which is near Palmwoods, which is just in that same area, that actually followed some Edward de Bono's six hats theory. And so I went, you know, the image of them roasting my son for the crackling, for the fat, or the puppy in the dream, was, you know, that the teachers really only wanted the fat. They just wanted the marks. They, you know, and my son was a radical thinker. So anyway, I went to, I found this school that, checked it out the next day, which was, followed Edward de Bono's six hat theory of thinking. And so I actually ended up teaching some of this because I got along particularly well with the headmistress. And anyway, so you just the way you go about it is you the kids put on all these different hats, and you put on a white hat, and the white hat calls for information known or needed. And then you look at one problem, but you approach it like the six blind men who went to see the elephant. And the red hat signifies feelings, hunches, and intuition. So then you go, how do I feel about it? And the black hat is, you know, like some, the devil's advocate or why something may not work. And, the yellow hat is, symbolizes, brightness and optimism. So an optimistic view about Palestine. And the green hat focuses on creativity and possibilities and alternatives and new ideas. And the blue hat's used to manage the thinking process. So anyway, it's a really fascinating thing. And I do suggest that parents, get into these, Edward de Bono. He's an absolute genius, on the six thinking hats, in terms of what we can do. But anyway, we're just going to take a short break. We'll see who's left when we come back. And Vin's going to play us the song because he's a good boy. Thanks so much, Vin. Thanks so much, Vin. You're wonderful.
Okay, your clear song up. Oh, God. I tell you, Max, I don't envy what you're doing, man. That's a hell of a thing.
Oh, trying to get into Gaza.
Yeah. We put it out there one night. I put the suggestion out there that why don't the Irish people invite the population of Gaza to come to Ireland? We've lots of fucking room.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's the thing. It would be good, you know? Mm. But, I mean, it's just hard. It was...
Well, we got shot down. I mean, I was like, what the fuck? People were shooting it down. What the fucking... Suddenly, I remember all these protests in Ireland and Palestinian flags, and I put that idea out, and people who had been waving Palestinian flags were suddenly saying, hold on a fucking minute, Vin, what are you doing?
Yeah, we're racists.
Hmm. But yeah, I mean, it got to the point there where, like, I'm all booked to leave in the morning, you know?
Right.
But,
Your main aim going over this time, Max?
Well, I want to go over and make this documentary.
Sorry, just trying to get yourself fucking blown up.
I want to go and make a documentary about what's going on over there. But then I'm finding out, like, I've spent the last 3 or 4 days trying to organize entry, you know, transport across the Sinai. And it's got to the point where...
It seems like an impossible task, unless you had some sort of a military operation behind you or something, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I've had my friends say, look, it's not good, mate. You could go over there and just, I mean, all I can say, Max, is go and meet your destiny. You know, either you get through or you don't. But, you know, you're talking about your life, you know. And I'm saying, well, yeah, so it's all very well for Gillian to say, oh, there'd be cameras in there. But hang on, like, I've got to get there first, and I'm likely to get kidnapped or killed just getting across the Sinai. So it's a lot easier to get across there from a Palestinian at the moment, you know.
I think you're right about the confiscation, because there's less and less photographs or anything being put up anywhere.
Yeah, it's
well,
it's,
yeah, well, they are. He even said, oh, Canon 5Ds and stuff, they're taking them, and that's exactly what I've got, a Canon 5D. So, and he even mentioned it by name, said, yeah, you'll have to make it look like it's broken to get it through, you know. And then there's the whole thing, well, if it's broken, we might as well take it anyway if it's broken, you know.
So, Can you upload them? Can you actually just get people to send you some film, get some footage sent to you and get some audio and actually make the film from afar?
Well, look, I can do what I can, but the internet in Gaza is really bad. When I was in there, like, there was a 15-minute clip I uploaded of me and Ken doing a freestyle on the rooftop. It took me something like 16 attempts to upload it. It took something like 9 hours or something to upload this 15-minute YouTube clip. It's even like, once I get in there, it's getting the footage out again as well, because there's 6 checkpoints to get across, you know.
And we're back with Mac. We were just talking in the break about well, you were talking with John McCann. Do you want to continue that conversation with John a tiny bit? Because John's very interested in Palestine.
What were we talking about, John?
Dragged him in.
We were mentioning about, you know, the difficulty. I was asking you really, you know, what your purpose was in trying to get there. Now, I know what your purpose is, but given the prevailing circumstances at the time, at this point in time, it seems like a very risky, absurdly risky chance to take. And I'm wondering, I suppose really, as I'm saying that, somebody has to try and do what you're thinking of doing. But I don't know. I think it would need a military operation at this point.
Well, that's the thing, you know. It's really difficult to get across the Sinai. And I know for a fact that they're confiscating camera equipment at the Suez Crossing. And there's at least three reporters that have been locked up recently just trying to get across there. And plus, once you get through, then there's the possibility that you're going to get kidnapped in the Northern Sinai region just because you're traveling across in a cab, you know. So it's funny. Like I said, there are military or aid operations that are happening from Kuwait, and there is a possibility of a ship getting in there from Turkey. So there are other options that are open. And the ticket's still there. And look, I want to go in and make a documentary. So if I'm going to have the camera confiscated on the way in there, then there's not much point in trying to go in and make a documentary. And if I'm going to have the footage confiscated on the way out, then again, there's not much point.
Probably the major networks. What's the situation with them?
Well, I've contacted a guy from Press TV, so I'm trying to find a way in through Press TV. There's a few options that I've still got open. So there are ways of possibly getting in there and possibly getting out again, but I'd need to be with some reasonably mainstream and well-known type people to do it. You know? At the moment, it's just too risky to go in there by myself.
I'm trying to find out what other media is actually in there at the moment.
Well, there's only really Press TV and I think RT. About the only media that are in there. There might be some CNN or whatever, but we're not hearing anything from these guys, CNN and NBC and BBC. I think there is some BBC reporters in there as well, but how much do you hear from them? So if I'm going to go there and just get, go missing in the Sinai, then it's counterproductive, you know? As much as I want to go there, I've got to try to be sensible about it, especially because I'm taking this young camera guy with me, you know? So, I mean, I can't just go out on my own. I need a cameraman with me while I'm in there. So I've got to be a bit responsible taking someone into a place like this, you know?
Yeah. I found during the bad times a few months ago, those horrendous times, the pictures that you were looking at, you know, some of them were genuine and some of them weren't genuine. And of course, the Israelis had a special ops team there to monitor Facebook and YouTube and everything and send in their own pictures, whatever they wanted to do, so they could reverse it. But someone who doesn't speak the language, if it's written in Arabic or whatever it is, wouldn't know, or the uniforms, point out the uniforms, who's fighting with who, or is that in that town, is that Gaza, or is that somewhere else, is that in Syria, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I saw a thing yesterday, for instance, settlers supposedly going into, Jewish settlers going into a house that a woman lived on her own. She looked about 70 or 80. And they just walked into the house and she was basically evicted from her home. And there was a lot of guys there. She was there on her own. But you're looking at it, but you're not sure. It never gives... this happened on a particular time in a particular part, you know, to verify that it's actually happening there.
Yeah.
That's what's the point, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it does happen quite a lot in the West Bank. I mean, the settlements come all the time. You know, people are expelled all the time in the West Bank. So it's a pretty standard thing. If you've got soldiers expelling an Arab woman from a home, then it's very, very likely that it's Israeli soldiers in the West Bank. That's basically where it happens. It's an ongoing thing. But yeah, I know what you're saying. We just see these images and we don't know where they come from. And I think a lot of it is done that way just to create that air of disbelief, you know, so people really don't really know what they're looking at all the time, you know. And they're used to images coming out of these areas. They're just used to seeing images of distress come from the air, so they become desensitized to it.
Yeah, that's a problem, isn't it? We do become desensitized and we get back to this feeling, as I was saying, of learned hopelessness. And this is something we really have to work on, and bringing it back, because we've sort of probably got about 20 minutes to go. I'm bringing it back to grassroots empowerment and what can we do today to empower our children? What the fuck can we do today, Max?
Well, we've got to spread information, darling. We've got to spread information to people in the nicest way we can, in a manner that will move them towards a doorway where they can discover the truth for themselves. We've got to lead by example in our communities. We've got to be a shining light in our communities. We've got to be a pleasure to be around. We've got to become friends with people. Now, if you can become friends with people, then they're going to listen to your political views a little bit more. But you have to be their friend first, which means maybe you have to make a few sacrifices. Maybe you got to go to a ball game or do something that you don't really want to do just to get to know these people.
Go to a ball.
Well, just to get to know these people on their terms a little bit, you know, and just break down the barriers with people. You know, when you're doing something, if you're baking some bread or making some biscuits or doing something, make a little bit extra and give some to the neighbors, you know. If you're having a bit of a barbecue or a lunch on Sunday afternoon, invite the people next door over to share it with you. You know, just break down the barriers with people. Get to know people a little bit. All of these things make a difference. That's what we can do. We can make a difference, and we can question authority in the right way and in a respectful way. Like I said, anything that makes you step outside of your moral compass, question it in the right way. Why would you be required to do that? And if there's legislation which has caused this travesty of justice and this travesty of humanity to occur, you'd like the officer to pursue the matter. You'd like to know who enacted this legislation, because you'd like to have them charged with abuse of office. You know, things like this. Just say it nicely to people. I'd like to follow this through, because I consider this to be an abuse of office, and I'm not willing to blindly follow legislation which causes me to deviate from my moral compass and which views humanity as being expendable. And if we are required to abide by any such legislation, I'd like to know why. I'd like to know who the politician is who's put these rules in place, so I can have them charged with abuse of office. And you say it in the right way, say it in a nice enough way, and if enough people are saying it, well, they're going to start to realize that the public's had enough, and we're prepared to use their system against them, because it's the best we've got at the moment, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I always say that, you know, just to make any cake, particularly, you know, a really sort of phenomenal cake, you have to put a lot of different ingredients in it, you know, even if, you know, like there's many ingredients go to make any situation, you know, it's what they call interdependent origination, you know, everything is interdependent. There are many cooperative causes. And so I think if we try and bring all the ingredients together,
Well, everybody's got a piece of the puzzle. There's so many people now speaking out against this system, and everybody's arguing with each other on their way being the right way. Well, I think everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, and until we're prepared to bring it all to the table and sit down and have some respectful dialogue, we're not going to get anywhere. But we've got to be prepared to listen to each other, and we've got to be prepared to stop shouting everybody else down and realize that even if we don't agree with something, we don't agree with someone's solution, well, they're giving you the best they can. They're giving you what they've come up with. They realize there's a problem, and they're making an honest attempt at providing some mechanism that they believe may work. And there may be a thread of gold in there if we're prepared to look at it, at least listen to it. But we've got to put our egos aside and actually sit down and start having some respectful dialogue and start operating out of integrity in what we do. And so if we operate out of integrity when standing up against this system, then we have to have an effect against it. Because if we're honest and we're in integrity and we're simply being respectful and asking questions from a correct moral perspective, then the system hasn't got anywhere to go. Because it just demonstrates itself as being corrupt in front of more and more people when it's approached by this manner. So it has to be careful. Mm. Has to go and kind of hide behind the shadows a little bit and back down a little bit when you start presenting things in the right way.
Well, this is one reason I have so much hope in Ireland, you know, in terms of like I just feel as though it was a lucky sort of stumble to stumble into Ireland, because and to stumble into direct you know, well, we had Ben Gilroy here today, you know, just absolutely amazing, you know, to stumble into people who are actually in a position with the Irish Constitution to fight the system within the system, within legalities within the system, if it's correctly fought. And so I really keep, you know, we speak with people about sovereignty and people's internet radio, you know, people are always talking about being sovereigns, but I sit there and I go, still, you know, we can't end up with a completely lawless society. Something will have to sort of, or will appear to replace those sort of...
Can I add to that, Jill?
Yes, John.
Sorry for coming across you.
Where I'm going, but it's welcome.
It's a very good point Max is making, and you're also making it yourself. You see, what we've got to really do is, you know, while we're out there, we're all giving out about everything, as Max says, which is right. And we're all learning more about how it's all going wrong. So we kind of know what all the problems are. But we're not going to ever take it by force. There's nobody here associated with us here is thinking about taking anything by force. So in order to achieve anything, we've got to make the people that we're trying to change lose their fear of losing everything that they have, which means that if we want change, we have not to take what they have. Just be happy that we have a say and everybody can have what they want. But we're not going to take away the spoils of a lifestyle that they're used to. They're never going to give that up. But if we can make them understand that I don't want the millionaire's house or the millionaire's money or somebody else's wealth. I don't want that. And anybody that I've met here, that's not what it's about. You know, stopping that fear from that sector and everybody working together for the benefit of everybody. So that means anybody can become a multimillionaire and still become whatever they want to be, as long as they're not treading on the toes of others and robbing resources and all the rest of it. So I think it's a very long road, but that's the way we have to think, because the alternative is only force, and force is what they use, and that's absolutely pointless. It never gets anywhere. And in relation to Gaza, I suppose, it's very, very much like Ireland in lots of ways, what's happening over there. And we're still fighting that fight here in our own little way, in the way we're doing it now, rather than taking up arms. We're trying to do it by knowledge. We're trying to play their system, as Max says, in order to stop people from being thrown from their homes. People losing everything, you know, because of some corporate entity that it's all made up and all. We have to fight all these things. But we also, you know, have to take into consideration that if you have everything, you're not going to readily give it up. So we have to make them think, at least, well, not make them think, but do it in a way that they don't feel threatened.
Well, you need to see what you're going to win. You know, there's the BIS and the BAS. There's the behavioral activation system and the behavioral inhibition system, and we respond to both. So it is sticks and carrots. I mean, I can never catch my horse with a bloody stick. I can tell you that now. Like, I learned so much about people by my horses and my relationship with my horses. And, you know, like, I have one particular horse who's really, like, she tried to kick me in the head and she tried to bite my grandson's nose off and, you know, I developed this relationship over 7 years with this horse because she was treated like a breeding cow. She's, you know, I've got rare breed horses. And, anyway, her name's Destiny and she's an absolute darling. And our relationship has softened so much that I just stand with her and her lips don't stop nibbling me. She licks me. She's kind to everybody. And yet other people would go, you know, what a horrible horse. I don't want to go anywhere near that horse. But if you just find how to connect, you know, in several different ways by many, many, many different gestures, as you say, you do, you know, you find where you connect and where you connect is where the love is, isn't it? You know, that's a true, deep spiritual, you know, trust and connection, and it takes a hell of a lot of work. Like, once she bit me and I slapped her on the nose and I realized it may have been a love bite, but I was scared it was going to get worse. And that took about 2 years to overcome. Well, what I'm really saying is, you know, like we're flight or fright creatures, and we either run to things or we run away from things. So what I'm basically saying is that, you know, to engage other people is exactly as you said, Max, and as you were saying, John, and that is we have to find where we can connect and where we feel like working together and going for a goal, you know, where we feel that there is a reward, because we're going to act more for rewards. And so we need to recognize that the reward isn't monetary, that the reward is lifestyle. It's living in peace. You know, I think it's hilarious that they both say shalom, peace. They greet each other with peace, and they're fighting each other in the Gaza for for the example of the day, which is where your focus is at the moment, and which is, well, Max, and which is incredibly important thing for us to remember.
Well, the thing is, like, the people in Gaza, I mean, they're just defending themselves. They always have been. The people in Palestine have always been defending themselves. People in Palestine have never attacked Israel. Israel's been an invading, aggressive force for the last 67 years. All they've ever done is defend themselves against this aggressive force. So it's an interesting situation. It pains me when people say, well, there are two sides to this conflict. Well, there's not really. There's one side. There's one race that's desperately trying to stay alive and the other race that's desperately trying to kill them all. That's what's going on. And that's what's been going on for the last 67 years. But like with this system, it's like what John was saying before. I mean, I don't want the rich houses of the people. I don't want any of their stuff. I just want to be able to live my life in freedom. I want to be able to see my brothers and sisters living their lives in freedom. I want the people in Gaza to be free to do whatever they want to do, to travel the world the way everybody else can, to be recognized as human beings the way everybody else is. That's the problem.
But this is so diabolical.
Well, the people in Gaza are non-humans. The people in Palestine are non-humans, and I find that offensive. I find it offensive there would be people on this planet who are treated as non-humans in such a public manner. I mean, it isn't just in Gaza. It's in Rwanda. It's in Panama. It's in all over Africa. It's all over the world. There's all sorts of bad stuff going on. But this is so public. It's so in your face. It's something that everybody knows, and it's so easily fixable if people would simply pay attention to it. And so that's why it's been such a focus for me. And plus, having gone there and met the people, these are beautiful people. Very, very giving, very caring people. And they're caught in a living hell, and they have no voice. Nobody cares. They're painted as terrorists, and they're not. You can't even imagine what it's like for the people in there, what they're forced to live through every day. It's absolutely horrendous. And so it offends me. And that's why I do what I do. I think that it's something that could be used to wake up the rest of the world, because this is apart from the fact that it's just discarded human beings, it's also a system of warehousing and surplusing human beings, as I've said so often. And it's a system that we'll see applied to the rest of the world if we don't pay attention. So it gives us an opportunity to fix the problem. And it's right there in our face. It's been there for years. Why don't we fix it? Why don't we stand up and do something? Stand up and say something, you know?
But even if we do stand up and say something, and a lot of people are standing up and say something.
Well, it's the approach. It's the approach people have. People do it as a let's hate the Jew fest. And it's not hating the Jews. It's the Israeli system. The people of Israel are programmed by the Israeli system. And we need the people of Israel to wake up as well, because the people of Israel are the only things that are going to change the Israeli government. That's the only thing that's going to change it. So attacking these people and hating the Jews isn't going to fix anything. You know, it's just buying into their program that everybody hates them, you know, which is the program that they're running. So they're in this constant state of defense, which is what makes everybody hate them. It's a classic program that they're running.
It's a great game.
It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And we have to step above all of that and realize that we need these people to wake up to themselves. I mean, I don't hate the Jews. I don't hate the people of Israel. I'm disgusted by the actions of the Israeli government. And I feel, you know, amazed more than anything at the state of the consciousness in Israel, because they're so programmed. But I feel sorry for them. I mean, I don't hate them. I love them. I feel sorry for them for the programs that they're running. But, you know, we've got to put it all down our programs as well, because people are programmed into hating them as well. And that's the wrong way of looking at it, you know. You can't hate these people.
Hate disturbs the mind and disconnects you from the, for want of a better word, the source. You know, it disconnects you from clarity. This is why I work really, really hard on creating any sort of othering with other people. You know, like we have to always say, what's their motivation? Why are they doing this? You know, how would I be in a situation like that, you know, if I was programmed that way?
You'd be exactly the same. So would I. If I'd grown up in that situation, I'd probably be exactly the same. So how do you hate these people? You can't. You know, you gotta try to see through the veil, see through the cloud, and do things in a different way. Just approach things in a different way.
Mm, it's absolutely true. I'm just reading the chat box at the moment. So it does distract me so slightly, but they're being hilarious in there at the moment. But anyway, we'll ignore them because they're having too much fun. But, Max.
Wish you well with your venture.
Well, yeah, if I get in there, I mean, maybe another month, maybe a month from now I'll get in. Like I said, the ticket's still open, but I've just got to try other options. I think to go in there just with, and try to cross the Sinai in a cab would be foolhardy at the moment.
Yeah, and maybe if we're on the positive side, a month might be a totally different place, you know, with any.
Well, you never know. You never know. It changes day by day, you know. Once reports change a little bit and, I mean, like I said, but I might be able to get in with an aid convoy. There's other ways I can use to get in there. It was just finding access was the hard part, finding a way to get an invitation to actually enter the strip because it's very difficult to actually get an invitation to enter at the moment because of recent events. And so I actually did get an invitation to enter, but it was from a private citizen who's connected to a charity organization. And so I got the charity organization to sponsor me, but they can't get me across the Sinai. Whereas the way I was trying to get in was like through organizations such as Press TV or through the Aid Flotilla in Turkey or through the Kuwaiti people who had run the aid missions. But I kind of backed off from that because I'd suddenly got this invitation from this charity organization. But now, okay, well, you can't get me actually across the Sinai. So because I've got to do that off my own bat, well, maybe I'm better off looking at back to one of these other organizations and going actually in with them in one of their convoys. So it's just seeing which is going to be the most productive way of doing it. But, I mean, going over there just because I'm keen to go and just taking the first opportunity and just going in there gung-ho may be quite irresponsible. So, yeah, you've got to be rational about this sort of stuff. It's not like
a bit of luck.
Yeah, well, it's not like you're going for a holiday to the Caribbean, so, you know.
You know, because things do change. Maybe not as quickly as like, but
they do, you know, but as I feel, my intuition is just telling me that I should back off at the moment. So that's what I'm doing. I think it's best to listen to my intuition.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the meantime, children are getting their arms and legs blown off and people are playing computer games, with real life targets, which is an absolute tragedy. Max, we're just at the top of the hour. What I'm wondering is if you'd like to tell us, give us the links to the six little films that you've made.
Find them all on the website. My website is thecrowhouse.com. If you go there and click Sights and Sounds at the top, that'll drop you down the page to where the six films are located. They're all there. There's hundreds of hours of radio archives there. There's the six films I've done. There's over 1,000 pages on the Crow House now, so there's a lot of information there. It's all for free. There's no advertising. So, yeah, go check it out, thecrowhouse.com.
Vin beat me to it. Thanks, Vin, for putting that in the chat. Yeah, and the six films would be really interesting, for people to watch. So, look, I really have to say, I think one thing is a lot of stuff is about funding too, you know, like, being able to afford to keep getting the information out there in terms of people's internet radio. If people would like to click the donate button, it would be a wonderful thing. And same for you, Max. It looks as though, you know, you've been funded for going to Gaza, but no doubt, you know, we always have trouble when we're doing things in an alternative way. So that I wanted to say that. Click the donate button, please, people. And Max Eigen, I'm so glad to have met a fellow Australian who's interested in a lot of the things that people need to be interested in, and I hope that you stay on the airways for a long, long time, and you know, get to keep putting out alternative messages.
Jill, if I can just come in there, if anybody wants to make a donation, and just type the word Max, we'll make sure it gets to Max.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. If you want to donate to Max Bill Gilroy, Max Gilroy, Max Eigen, yeah, please do that. Yeah, Max, we'd love to support you.
Well, thank you, darling. It's the only way everything gets done is through community support. So, I mean, it was wonderful to get the trip funded to Gaza. But like I said, that's on hold at the moment. So at least I haven't lost a ticket, though. I mean, it's on hold, and I will get there. I just make sure I can actually get there first.
And then you get there, and then you come out again, and then, you know, to get the film spread across the world, which, you know, to make it that sort of quality, and that's why you need such a, you know, a television quality camera, you know, it's half the problem, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you can do it with just about anything these days, but the problem is that they're just not available in Gaza, you know. It's just not the sort of stuff they allow to be imported, you know. There is cameras in there, but they're pretty old. I mean, there's stuff that the news teams take in there, but you can't just go to a store in Gaza and buy a new Canon 5D or something. It just doesn't work that way.
All right. Well, Vin's got a really good song waiting for us. Max Eigen, maybe you'd like to come on the show again another time and give us an update in, you know, a few weeks or months or whenever it sort of works best for you. That would be lovely. Is there anything last things you want to say, Max?
No, I'm pretty good. Just, do pay attention to what's going on in Gaza though, folks. Don't, because the media isn't reporting it. Don't take your eyes off. Do pay attention. Do continue to make noise for these people, because they don't have a voice and they need us to be one for them.
Yeah, that's just completely right. So, you know, compassion, and use your voice and whatever other sort of doors of body, speech or mind that we have to protect one another, because it doesn't just protect them. We protect ourselves, you know, even though that's a selfish motivation, but it does.
Well, we have to. We have to do that as well. And make noise in your community, folks. Get to know the people out there in your community. We've got to put the power and common unity back in our communities, because we have to make a difference. We've got to rein our governments in. We cannot allow the world to continue going in the direction that it's going. And the only ones that are going to make a difference is us. So we need to step up to the plate. And that means you.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. So
nice talking to you anyway, Max. Good luck for the future with that, and keep up the great work, yeah?
Thank you, John. You too, brother.
Yeah, thank you, John McCann. You're an absolute angel friend of mine, and Vin, who I'm totally devoted to, and Ben Gilroy, thank you so much for coming on People's Internet Radio. And Max Eigen, thank you so much. Good night, everyone.
Night.
Night.